Hello everyone, welcome to another TheOneLiner.com podcast. We're still at the Edinburgh Film Festival. I'm still Scott Morris, and that's still Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
Let's just get cracking with Cigarette Girl. Drew?
Okay, Cigarette Girl then. In the near future, smoking has been pushed to rundown areas in the outskirts of cities known as smoking zones, and smokers treated like pariahs. Cigarette Girl, that's the only name she gets given, makes her living selling cigarettes. Until that is, her chain-smoking grandma ends up in hospital as she decides to quit smoking, which for some reason also means she quits her job. That's only one of several problems that follow on. Thereafter, there follows a mishmash of psychological torments as her heroine attempts to give up nicotine, many of these being personified by her haunting by the Marlboro Man, and a weak and mostly nonsensical gangster stroke drug dealer revenge plot, though nothing that needs avenging has apparently happened at all. The plot is very muddled, and the writer doesn't seem to have decided whether or not smoking is in fact illegal in the film's world. The way that trade in and addiction to cigarettes is depicted suggests it's an illicit thing, akin perhaps to heroin dealing. But yet other things, the fact there are designated smoking zones, the need for ID to purchase them, and the fact that the gangster figure is using his smoking club trade as a front for prostitution and other drug trades, suggest otherwise. Unless, of course, and it's quite possible because this film's not well written at all, it makes sense to the filmmakers that a criminal would be using an illegal trade as cover for an illegal trade. It's got delusions of grandeur. At times it seems to be trying for a comic book visual style, most obviously that of Frank Miller's Sin City, but it really only manages it in two scenes, and even in those two it doesn't manage it particularly well. It also feels very much like there's a pro-smoking, or at least pro-smokers, agenda behind this, which frankly is tiresome and equally badly crafted. But the very worst thing about this film is that the acting is universally terrible. Worse even than the sort of acting seen in the likes of Mega Shark vs. Giant Octopus.
Surely no such thing is possible.
I wouldn't have thought so, but the acting in this is actually worse. And the terrible acting is matched only by the atrocious dialogue. But again, even worse than Mega Shark vs. Giant Octopus.
Surely no such thing is possible.
Atrocious dialogue and a paper-thin plot. And it's the first and so far only film I've seen at this year's festival that is entirely without merit. So on no account whatsoever should you see this. I just perhaps you'd feel chastened, don't you? You should be careful what you wish for. Only a couple of days ago, Scott, I was saying that I very much wanted to see something very, very terrible that you'd see with Brilliant Love as a sort of low point, the marker by which I could judge the other films. I really should have kept my mouth shut.
The festival delivers once again.
Yeah, it's crap. It's all kinds of crap. Avoid it.
Fair enough. Right, well then, over in Austria, although it's maybe a German film, I think, a character named Johann Rettenberger finishes his stint in prison in The Robber. He is, notably, in there for armed robbery. When he gets out, there's two things on his mind. One is transferring his intensive long-distance running training from exercise yards and treadmills to marathons, and the other is, well, robbery. The narrative of the film isn't vastly more complicated than showing how Johan achieves these goals, with the slight addition of rekindling a relationship with an old flame. He achieves both aims in short order, as it turns out, and most of the final half to a third of the film simply follows Johan as he goes on the run from the police, who inevitably rumble his shotgun-toting bank stick-up antics before long and launch a massive manhunt through the remote parts of Austria. Appropriately enough, the film's pacing essentially mirrors Johan's heart rate by being stoically paced aside from these robbery-slash-evasion scenes, which go off the charts. There's a real kinetic fervour about the scenes that's a joy to watch. Outside of this, it's not quite so compelling, but it's still a pretty decent watch. Probably by nature of profession, Johan is guarded and standoffish, so he may not ooze charisma, but there is something kind of fascinating about his Iceman act. Narratively, given how little really occurs in The Robber, I can't recommend it if you're looking for a ripping yarn, but in character, pacing and camera technique, it's definitely worth checking out. That last bit sounds a little bit too dismissive. I actually genuinely enjoyed the film, but I'm coming up a little short on justification to tell you why you should go and see it, but regardless of that, you'll just have to trust me when I say it's one of the better films I've seen in this year's festival.
Right, next then we move to the United States, or at the very least Iceland masquerading as the United States, and The Good Heart. After suffering a heart attack caused by irony, his myocardial infarction being brought on by his vigorous destruction of the relaxation tape he found infuriating, misanthropic, misogynistic bigot Jacques, played by Brian Cox, ends up in a shared hospital room where he meets Paul Danos Lucas, a gentle and generous soul who tried to take his own life while living on the streets and feeling alienated from the human race. As the two struck up something of an accord, Jacques seeks out Lucas after leaving hospital and decides to make him his apprentice of sorts, with a view to Lucas taking over the bar he owns when he checks out for good. As the two spend more time together, their personalities begin to rub off on each other. Lucas becomes harder and meaner, and Jacques begins to soften somewhat. The film's an almost tactile griminess about it, as does Brian Cox's character, and the performances from Cox and Dano are solid, but I found that their characters just didn't work. Jacques, who is obsessive about making perfect cappuccino, apparently doesn't own a cloth or flash liquid to clean his manky pub, and is from the beginning unrelentingly and intensely unlikable. And Lucas's transformation into a more unpleasant, meaner man is unconvincing, particularly given that a huge change in his character, noted by Jacques, seems to happen after a relationship with a third person who enters their lives that could well have lasted just a couple of days. The film carries on there to an inevitable ending, if you paid any attention to events at the start and the name of the film. And it's frankly deeply, deeply unsatisfying because the characters involved are so unpleasant. As I said, the performances are solid enough, but I couldn't recommend anyone went to see it because it's not an enjoyable enough film, and the performances aren't outstanding enough for it to stand on the merits of that alone. So I'm afraid this one's not for me.
I really liked it, just to be contrary. It makes,
as is your right,
no sense whatsoever in terms of character, or, well, I suppose a plot does, but it's, if you're looking for a realistic character piece, then this is certainly not the one to go to. It is deliberate, I think, how polar extreme opposite these two characters are. I suppose it doesn't really explain how any of these characters got into the situation, but I don't think someone who is relentlessly nice as a Lucas Paul Dano's character would survive on the streets, and no. I don't see how anyone would still drink in Brian Cox's bar. It's plainly not even attempting to be realistic. It's almost more of a fable than anything else. But I found it quite funny. As long as you go in understanding that these characters are no way meant to be realistic, you can kind of let Brian Cox away with his rampant racism, misogyny, and general curmudgeonliness. And if you're not taking it as a serious slice of life, you can view that as being kind of funny. Same with Paul Dano's almost glib niceness at everything. It is, I thought, at least it's quite brave how it manages to sabotage any commercial appeal with its final act as well.
So the final act is what I particularly disliked, and because the characters just seem, well, they're kind of ridiculous in their extremes, really. So I simply couldn't find myself liking them. You can't say that Lucas is unlikable. But it's a bit, this guy, I don't know, he's a bit wet, he's too nice, he'd probably be dead, I don't really care. And Brian Cox, as I said, just unlikable from the start. So when you get to the end, it feels like a kick in the teeth, even though you know it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
It just feels like a kick in the teeth compared to the other character, and I just found it very unsatisfying.
Tough to say, if you're looking for any sort of drama from the film, it's probably failing. I mainly liked it because I found it quite funny, because I thought Brian Cox was quite funny. I thought the interplay between Cox and Dano and mostly the bar patrons was pretty funny as well, so it was keeping me amused on that level. But yeah, if you're looking for a satisfying drama and character arc, or really any kind of narrative to it, then no, it's not the film for you. All I can say is I just found it quite funny and enjoyed it. But yeah, there's certainly solid reasons for not enjoying it. We'll grant you that much.
I mean, I found small portions amusing, at least. I wouldn't go quite so far as feel like having found it funny, but mildly amusing a couple of bits, but those were really few and far between. And then adding all the other bits and the curious sense of time not passing. Yeah, not for me.
Next up, Skeletons. Previous years haven't given me a great hit rate with British comedies at the IFF, which I suppose pretty much reflects the state of the British film industry as a whole. Regardless, this one turned out to be a bit of a welcome surprise. Two characters, Davis and Bennett, are practitioners of a procedure, a sort of psychic exorcism come investigation type thing, entering into the either accidentally or deliberately repressed memories of those who hire their company. They record what they find there and report back to the clients. The first thing you'll have to accept about this film is that this procedure actually works. It works so effectively that the results on the clients can be devastating. Davis's attitude is simply to report the results, get out and never look back, but Bennett is beginning to feel increasingly guilty about the state he's leaving people in. Davis is hardly perfect either, spending his downtime boozing and glow-chasing, a procedure where he delves back into his own memories from happier time to re-experience them, just as he did it the first time through. Sadly, this isn't good for someone's mind, leading to, as their boss Jason Isaacs, the Colonel, has it, a build-up of psychic detritus that adds further risk to a procedure that's already dangerous, with the constant threat of a botched operation having them turn Bulgarian. A horrid fate. You can't fault the setup for originality, at least. The bulk of the problems they're going to have in this film come when the pair are contracted to a difficult case, seeking out the location of a lady, Jane's long-lost husband. The husband seems to have done a classic nipping out for a pint of milk vanishing act, and Jane's getting a little tired of her speculative digging of the surrounding countryside to find his body. Their 21-year-old daughter Rebecca hasn't spoken to anyone in years, and while the youngest boy in the family seems relatively normal, it's fair to say it's hit the rest of the family pretty hard. While this job itself is far from routine, the complications here often come more from Bennett's attitude towards the job and Davis's glow-chasing, and the suspicion that Rebecca may have the same dubious gifts that the guys have. Plainly, this is not the most conventionally plotted of films, so one of its greatest achievements is that it manages to present itself in a way that is not so overwhelmingly weird that it's dismissed out of hand. Skeletons manages to pull this off, and remarkably enough, without bogging the film down at all with long, involved explanations of what the procedure is, or any other irrelevant technical details which are welcome glossed over. Now, I have the feeling that this has been labelled as a comedy due to a lack of any other particularly relevant genre to pigeonhole it into. It's certainly enough of an oddball to exclude it from serious dramas, and I suppose there's no other genre in which we would accept a character suffering an accident that makes them speak in Bulgarian for about a third of the film's running time. That said, it's not continually going for the comedy jugular. There's a constant level of gentle amusement, mainly coming from the situation, but there's no outright pratfalls or gag setups. The banter between Davis and Bennett is often decently witty and gives some more grounded reasons for caring about the characters. While Jane and the family are moulded in a typical British eccentric style, they are quite likeable, and once the truth of their plight outs, it's easy to empathise with them. Now, while Skeletons might not be the out-and-out funniest film you'll see this year, or even at this festival, it is a damn good yarn. It's got likeable performances, and it's consistently original, and those reasons alone, it's definitely worth a couple of hours of your time.
Sounds quite interesting. What actually piqued my interest, although I chose to see something different that day, was when I read about it, it sounded almost like it was Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind in reverse, albeit from the point of the engineers rather than the engineered.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds interesting enough for me to look up at some point, so I may well do that. Right then, staying in Blighty, third star, this year's closing gala film. Terminally ill with cancer, Jim is taken by his friends Bill, Miles and Davey on a final trip to his favourite place in the world, Pembrokeshire's Barrafundle Bay. Given that the bay is a particularly remote location, Jim's cancer means he isn't always able to move under his own power, and that the group's complex dynamics supports an atmosphere where bickering is ever ready to break out, getting there isn't going to be easy. In essence, this is a road movie, calm relationship drama perhaps, albeit a road movie without any roads to speak of, replete with road movie staples of secrets, arguments, and encounters with absurd and somewhat surreal characters along the way. The four friends have histories and there are tensions there between them, and as is relatively typical for the type of film, there are points where they're getting on well and other points where the tension just becomes too much and somebody breaks out into a tirade against one of their friends. As each brings forth his opinions of himself and his friends, all involved achieve a catharsis and an important evaluation of themselves. The script of Third Star is sharply written with plenty of wit and humour, and the direction remarkably assured for a first-time feature director. But the film's real success is the superb acting from the four leads, with perhaps the biggest plaudits going to the dependably excellent and excellently named Benedict Cumberbatch, though really this would be a case of saying Cumberbatch gets an A+ while all others get an A. The relationships between the friends are compelling and real, and the undercurrents and tensions completely believable. Some of the revelations are predictable, and not all of the dialogue top-notch, perhaps a little cliché, so I wasn't entirely blown away by Third Star, but it's the best thing I've seen so far at this year's festival, and if for no other reason, although there are other reasons, the brilliant acting performances alone merit your attention, so it's definitely one to make the effort to see. He's very good.
That sounds a bit too worthy for me. Does it have any giant sharks in it?
It doesn't. I'm afraid that I must disappoint you there, but it's not sort of one of those particularly life-affirming sort of things when a character's dying, although there are uplifting moments in it. It's a bit more real feeling than that, and the acting is just, it's frankly superb. It's some of the best acting I've seen in quite some time, I think. I can't remember seeing any better performances this year than Cumberbatch in this, though I'm possibly just forgetting something, so I wouldn't take that as certain, but it's very, very much worth seeing. Not the happiest of films, perhaps, but it is worthy, and not worthy but dull.
Another British hopeful is The Kid. This film centres around the life of Kevin Lewis, and it is basically an autobiographical tale of his childhood. Born in the most working of working class environments, his family is frankly a nightmare. He has multiple brothers and sisters, but he in particular is singled out for abuse at the hands of his mother and father. He's locked in his room continually. He's very rarely let out apart from going to school, and he's shut back in his room. He's beaten. Generally, life is not good for the little boy, and funnily enough, this does not give him a particularly happy upbringing. After a while, he is taken away by social services, once the truth gets discovered about what his family's been up to. He's finally shown some love by the people in the children's home, particularly Uncle David, played by Bernard Hill. However, after a while, he winds up getting taken back into the family. The same thing is keep occurring, and it's then the only other bit of love coming in his childhood comes from a teacher, Colin Smith, played by Ian Gruffudd. This sort of thing is not a particularly useful upbringing for a kid, and as such, it's not too surprising when, even though he's continually trying to better himself and build a proper life, build a business, people are taking advantage of him because he's kind of guileless, this guy. People take advantage of him, he winds up getting increasingly muddled in a criminal underworld to the point where he's on the bare-knuckle fighting circuit and being taken complete advantage of as a frontman running a bar for a underworld linchpin. This tale is not a particularly happy one, but there is some light in the tunnel when he has a relationship with PA Gloria, played by Natasha McElhone. Lewis, by this point, of course, there's multiple actors playing as he grows up, but when he becomes a young adult, he's played by Rupert Friend. And this, basically, as an autobiographical tale, there's not an awful lot more to say about this. Kevin Lewis himself made this, came out with two books. So, as an autobiographical tale, it's quite good, you've got to say. It's fairly well acted throughout. It's obviously it's a fairly affecting tale. There's obviously an awful lot of bad things going on here, and so it does become quite easy to pull for Kevin. It's far from perfect. Although it is well acted, it's very, very heavy-handed. There's an awful lot of ladling on of overly orchestral scores while his parents are beating him up, things like that, which just seem a little overly contrived and sort of very desperate to start yanking on the tear ducts. But in general, it's an interesting story. It's well enough acted by everyone else. It's pacey enough. It could probably do with being a little shorter, but it's a pretty decent yarn. It's more or less enjoyable. I wouldn't recommend that anyone dash out to see it. It's one of the films with the higher production values. This one's certainly going to get a mainstream release, and I think it will do fairly well. It's a pretty decent film. I've seen better at the festival, but this one is certainly in the top half. Yeah, a mild recommendation from me there. Well, that's enough for this podcast. If you want to get in touch with us, podcast@theoneliner.com. Until then, we'll be back fairly soon with more film reviews from the Edinburgh International Film Festival. Goodbye from me, and goodbye from Drew.
Goodbye. Bye.